Everybody, and welcome to another episode of True Stories of Tinseltown. And I am very excited about our guest today. His name is Stephen Michael Shearer, and he wrote a wonderful book about Hedy Lamarr, and it's entitled Beautiful, The Life of Hedy Lamarr. And it is a great story. I told him I could not, and I couldn't put it down, and I read like every page, which I usually don't do. I kind of skip to my loo on some of it. And also, you know, he was friends with Robert Osborne, and Robert knew Hedy, so he did the introduction. And thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much, Grace, for inviting me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I mean, I just love that book. It was a really well written, so that you got into it, you know, and
well, thank you.
The whole thing.
It was interesting when I started the book. had written a book about Patricia Neal, An Unquiet Life. Patricia Neal, An Unquiet Life, and I knew Pat personally for the last 20 years of her life. I traveled a great deal with her. Attended film festivals, and well, we were great pals. So when I started Beautiful, this for a mainstream publisher, Macmillan, St. Martin's Press Macmillan, I wanted to do a book on Hedy Lamarr simply because there had not been a book about her other than her own notorious, quote, autobiography.
I read that. Unquote. We'll have to talk about that later. Yeah.
Right. And so when I chose the title Beautiful, I chose it because of the irony of that word. Hedy Lamarr was always taken at face value. She was undeniably one of the most beautiful women in the world and certainly on the screen. However, there lay below a very intelligent mind, and during her era, the 1930s and 1940s, especially for a screen actress, beautiful women were actually little more than film props. The true actresses of the screen in those days, Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, they were never really breathtakingly beautiful. They had their moments, but Hedy Lamarr was truly just breathtakingly beautiful. And when I started the book, I did talk to my mother, who was a young woman, a young adult, at the outbreak of World War II. And I asked her what society was like in those days. And she said, certainly for an intelligent woman, her brain, her abilities were best kept in American society, at any rate, at home, raising children. Hedy Lamarr was a brilliant woman and a very frustrated woman. When I started the book and interviewed the family, the children said how difficult it was for her to be accepted beyond face value. So when I confronted Hedy's daughter, Denise, she said, "I'll be glad to participate with you as long as you promise me one thing." And I agreed to that. And she said, "Please keep the title Beautiful." And that I did. So Beautiful, The Life of Hedy Lamarr, it was the very first complete biography of Hedy. There have been since a couple of other books, including Richard Rhodes' book, Hedy's Folly, which deals with her invention. So that was how the book started, how the concept came about. I had my second thoughts when I started doing my, I knew enough about Hedy Lamarr's life There had been a book many years ago, The Films of Hedy Lamarr, during the heyday of nostalgia in the early 70s. Mm-hmm. And that book, you know, of course, was the text from which I followed her career. Ecstasy and Me, the notorious, quote, autobiography, was more a scandalous book, which once in a while you could hear Hedy's voice. I wrote about it in Beautiful. It shouldn't be completely discarded because of its fictitious moments, but there are moments when you can hear Hedy talking about her career, not about the personal events that were written about in that book. So when I started doing my research at UCLA, the Academy Library, and, mm-hmm. and
I heard that's an amazing library.
Well, those are usually the first places I hit, mm-hmm. other than the New York Public Library of Performing Arts at Lincoln Center, and then all points in between. Eventually, it's a form of discovery when one writes about the life of someone else. And when I first started my research, I wasn't for sure if I wanted to continue with this project because there was so much litigation in Hedy's
oh
life
my goodness.
Toward the end of her life. But I knew Robert Osborne knew her. He stood beside her during the famous shoplifting scandal in
How
the 1960s.
Horrible. Yeah.
And Bob was a real close friend of hers. And so when I started talking about him, about her to him, he encouraged me a great deal to continue with it. He says she needs a dedicated, sincere biography, as I had written Patricia Neal in Unquiet Life.
Yeah, not some exploitive kind of, tabloidy kind of thing, which yours isn't at all. But it's truthful, but it's not like a tabloid, sensationalized kind of deal.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and that is something I explained to the children. You know, they had been burned so many times by journalists who wanted to talk about their mother, and then they dove right into Ecstasy, the film, which gave her notoriety worldwide in the early 1930s. And they dove into her shoplifting. And the children said, you know, we have been burned so many times. We're very leery talking to anyone. So I really had to do a song and dance to show them and give them copies of Patricia Neal to show what kind of work I do. And they thoroughly agreed. They were so gracious in opening up their archives, their letters, their pictures about their mom. And so I think I did a proper job on this book. I certainly loved every moment of it. Interestingly, too, at the 11th hour, when I contracted with the publisher, I got a phone call from the daughter of a very famous actor whose daughter was producing at that time. And she asked me, have you found a voice for Hedy Lamarr? And of course, I bent the truth a bit and said, oh, yes, of course. I hadn't yet. I had just begun the project. And she said, well, we're thinking about doing a film. I'll have my people talk to your people. So that stuck in my mind. Had I found a voice? I didn't quite know what that meant. I knew Pat Neal very well. And when I did my book on Patricia, I had to step back and be objective uh-huh. more times than none, simply because I loved her and adored her so much. I didn't know Hedy Lamarr. I didn't know Gloria Swanson, my third book. But Hedy Lamarr, I tried to find a voice. And like I said, during the course of writing a biography, you have millions of pieces of the puzzle you put together and try to see where this life has come from, where this life is developing, and where is it going. And at the 11th hour, I've said this oftentimes in interview, toward the end of the writing of the book, my own father was passing. Mm-hmm. And this is always a difficult time. You don't want to bring any journalist, any writer, just does not want to bring the emotions to the table, not to his or her work. Mm-hmm. But I was in deep talks late at night with Anthony Loader, Hedy's son, And we developed a bit of an empathy toward the woman. And just before I sent the manuscript, the final manuscript in, I heard her voice. I heard her talking. I heard what she was trying to say in her lifetime, if you will, at least my concept of it with the information I had researched and what I had been told and what I had discovered. And I went back through the manuscript and I rearranged certain things and I redeveloped certain things. And I finally realized what that meant. Did you hear, you know, it's not eerie, it's not Twilight Zone. I didn't hear voices speaking to me, but I did have, I think the word is, a better understanding of the woman and what made her who and who she was. And finally, when the book came out, the children read the final result and the family, and they said, yes, this is Hedy Lamarr. So I think that review, more than anything else,
of course, the children giving you the thumbs up, you know, yeah, because so, they knew their mother and they knew the life. That must have been, yeah, that is the best review you can get from the children of her. Of her kids, yeah. So how did you, how long did it take you to write the book?
Well, I had decided, Patricia Neal came out in 2006, so I wanted to jump right into another project.
I read that, too. At 2006, yeah, and, what a great book.
And I wanted to get into another project right away. I had been working in corporate in New York for 27 years, and after 9/11... I lost 11 colleagues in the North Tower, and my office was effectively closed. So I had a window of opportunity, if you will, for 2 years where I had to reconsider where I was in life. And I was 50 years old. I wasn't terribly happy with working in corporate. I used to be an actor. I have a bit of a creative sense about me. And I always wrote. I always wrote reviews and film and book reviews, and I did research for the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Patricia Neal was such a good friend. She said, "Well, are you ever going to write my biography?" And
I love her voice.
I thought, "Well, I've never written a book before, a biography before, but yes, I think I can do this." And I did it. I meditated a great deal. You know, if this was the direction I needed to go at that point, at beginning of Act Three. And it was, apparently, because it after Patricia Neal and Unquiet Life came out, then I did get a literary agent, and I got a mainstream publisher. They wanted a book right off, and I presented my proposal on Hedy Lamarr. And that, I believe, was in 2007. Mm-hmm. 2008, I contracted. During this period of time, I moved from New York to Las Vegas. I had a year-long gig with the Las Vegas Review-Journal, where I wrote about legendary Las Vegas headliners. Mm-hmm. And then in 2008, I moved to Minneapolis, St. Paul, because my in-laws were ailing, and came here and helped caregive for them until they passed away and chose to stay here. I finished Hedy Lamarr in 2009, and then I had been researching her for years. Usually it takes, if it's a fresh project, it usually takes 2 to 3 minimum, 2 to 3 dedicated 8 a.m. till 8 p.m. hours a day, to just simply do your research. Writing biography is collecting as much material, doing as many interviews, in my case, with film, watching as many films and a lot of television kinetoscopes, which are available at UCLA or USC. Oftentimes, I with Patricia Neal, I traveled to England to the British Film Institute. I've done research through archives around the world, certainly with Hedy Lamarr. The German, Austrian, and Czechoslovakian archives supplied me with a great deal of information. Once that's accumulated, then, you know, anybody can write a dictionary. Anybody can write a telephone book. The trick is to write a narrative that is intriguing, compelling, explaining to the reader why they are poring over these pages and why this subject matters. And so I finished the book in 2009, and then at that point, usually with a publisher, they have a year of edit process, mm-hmm. at minimum a year, 1 year of edit process and getting it ready for marketing. So Hetty came out, I believe it was October of 2010, and the kickoff was at Barnes & Noble, which is no longer there, Barnes & Noble at Lincoln Triangle in New York, mm-hmm. where I had attended those many years that I lived in New York. I attended many book signings there, and I always thought to myself, even when I didn't know I was going to become a biographer, I always thought to myself, I'd love to be on the other side of that table.
And you were.
And I finally, think about what you wish for, because dreams can come true. And so things happen. You live long enough, things happen. But in answer to your question, and again, it was long-winded, I apologize. Yes, Hetty Lamarr came out in 2010. I think it whole process probably took 3 years and four if you want to tag on some preliminary research.
Well, what I have to say is, you accomplished what you had set out to do, because I felt that I obviously knew Hetty Lamarr as a gorgeous woman. I have never seen her in Algiers, which I now know I have to see. I saw her in The Strange Woman. I saw her in I Take This Man. Is that the one with...
I Take This Woman.
Yeah, with Spencer Tracy. The one that was
this
big brouhaha.
It was also known as I Retake This Woman, because they
yes, that was a mess.
So many times, yeah.
And I saw the one with James Stewart. And I also saw H.R. Pullman Esquire. So, but there's
that
still...
That possibly is... H.M. Pullman Esquire is possibly her best film. She really handed in a remarkable performance.
I thought she was great.
And that is something, if I might interject, that is something I do want to mention. Hetty Lamarr had that lilting Viennese accent. She was beautiful to look at. You can't take your eyes off her. She was beautiful
really
to look
can't.
At on
yeah.
the screen. But that lilting Viennese accent to our ears here in the United States, to English speaking ears, it sounds lilting and you really can't. It seems like you really can't take it seriously. However, if you watch her work, if you watch her, certainly in H.M. Pullman Esquire, Tortilla Flat is another performance.
I've never seen that. I've got to check that out.
She worked with John Garfield, and any time as a former actor, I can vouch for this, anytime you work with a really fine actor on the stage and on film or whatever, they bring you up because it challenges you to do even better. And Hetty was working a second time. With Spencer Tracy in Tortilla Flat, and she knew he was a fine actor. John Garfield, she liked him very much, and in their scenes together in Tortilla Flat, their scenes together just spark. She's a lovely actress when given good material. You'll see when you watch Bombshell, the Hetty Lamarr story, the recent documentary. What did Louis B. Mayer give her after he tired of her? He gave her Tondaleo.
Yeah, I did see that.
the movie White Cargo,
yes.
which pandered to the libido of the servicemen.
Yes.
That's unfortunate, because there's work going on behind those eyes. You can see that in a couple of films. Just a simple film like Ziegfeld Girl, you can see it's all the glitz and glamour of Hollywood rolled up in with Judy Garland and Lana Turner in one movie. But even there are a couple of scenes, even in that Hetty really shines. And possibly, if you did see The Strange Woman and Dishonored Lady.
Dishonored Lady, yes, both.
Dishonored Lady's the only film she made with her third husband, John Loder. If you saw that particular film, there is an interesting, a very interesting scene where Haiti has to feign she's drunk. I mean, her character is drunk. And it is possibly one of the, Haiti didn't really drink in those days. And it was very well handled, very, very well executed on film. One of the best inebriation scenes I've ever seen, to tell you the truth.
And she underplayed it because people tend to overplay drunk.
They do. They do. And it can be a mockery. And it's certainly if you're an untalented actor, it'll show through. But Haiti handled it very well. It's a shame that she wasn't given, during her heyday, she wasn't given better material for her film output.
Yes. Yeah, so I want to talk a little bit about her in Vienna before she came to the States. She was quite beautiful, of course. She didn't want to be in school. She didn't care about all that stuff. And she became an actress. But the story, something that I think drove, which really broke my heart that I had never heard, was that she, a laundry man at 14, attempted to rape her one day. She never told anybody. And then the next time, he did. And she hit him over the head with an ivory statue. And she didn't tell her parents. She didn't tell anybody. And the mother saw the statue. She wanted to know why it's broken. He didn't tell her. And she slapped her face. So there you go. You know? So she carried that with her. How can you not? You know, you put that deep inside you. But how can you not forget that? You know?
Well, I think, you know, I can't speak for a 14 or 15-year-old girl. I do know what my teen years were like, and I certainly was not Haiti Lamar, but Haiti Lamar, at an early age, bought into her beauty. Mm-hmm. She was a beautiful child. You can tell by the picture. She was a beautiful child, and she was spoiled, the child of influential parents in Vienna. And she knew that her looks could help her get what she wanted. They certainly worked with her father. They certainly worked when she did crash the Sasha Tobin film studios in Vienna. Mm-hmm. She knew what her beauty could get for her. So she bought into that. Unfortunately, sometimes, you know, there's a yin and yang, and unfortunately, sometimes there are penalties that have to be paid. I don't know the complete story about that abuse. I do know what happened, and Haiti, you know, never really openly talked about it. Something in those days, and even today, that one doesn't. But she did carry that. You know, she knew how far her, at an early age, how far using her looks would get her, and where it would get her in trouble. And so, yeah, that her mother, she had, I think, like fathers and sons.
Yes.
I think mothers and daughters have issues. And
a little Haiti competition even, as well.
Possibly so. Mm-hmm. She was the light of her father's life, and her mother, of course, was her father's wife.
Right.
So possibly there was a little bit of competition there. I don't know. I can't speculate on that. But I do know that she and her mother did have issues, certain issues. She loved her mother, adored her mother, and vice versa. But it's very strange. Certainly, you know, I have older sisters, and I, you know, I reflect back to my upbringing and my mother's and sister's interactions. And so I can't, you know, this isn't, as a biographer, it isn't my job, unless it's set out from the onset, is not, I'm not trying to do a psychological study, whys and wherefores, but I think her mother was more upset with the fact that the statue was broken than anything else, and Haiti did not tell her mother, you know, what had happened.
And also, I'm sorry.
That's all right. So, at any rate, she did carry that. She also, you know, I think strove to use her looks to achieve more positive things in her life. At the age of 16, 17 years old, a famous theatrical impresario, Max Reinhardt, did say, this is the most beautiful girl in the world. And within minutes, over telegraphs throughout Europe, it spread. Before she ever came to this country, she was considered one of the most beautiful girls in the world.
How did that happen? Because she came out of a studio or something with him, and press was around, and he said that, right?
Well,
did
yes,
they even,
she
so had, they
was
laid
working
eyes
on the
her.
Stage. Yeah.
Yeah,
she was working in theater, and Otto Preminger had snuck her in to meet Max Reinhardt, and she was doing a play, and as they were rehearsing, he just casually said to a couple of pressmen who were in the theater that this is the most beautiful girl in the world. And apparently, they jumped right out of their seats and hit the telephones. And literally within 5 minutes, within hours, it was published in several papers throughout Europe that Haidee Kiessler was her real name. Haidee Kiessler is Max Reinhardt's hair. Max Reinhardt claims to be the most beautiful woman, girl in the world.
How old was she? 15 or 16?
16, 17 years old. She was very, very young. She had done a handful of films in Vienna. She was making a name for herself on the stage, and then came the call to do Ecstasy in Czechoslovakia. Mm-hmm. And she and her then lover, Herbert Mog, went to do this film, and when that particular film picture was released in Europe, it won all sorts of awards. It's a beautiful film.
I've seen it too.
Yeah, it's shown on Turner Classic Movies in prime time. Yes, there is a brief scene of shot of nudity, and in 1933, certainly by European culture, it was nada importante.
Yeah.
There was, however, a scene of simulated sex.
Yes.
And according to Haidee, it was simulated, and that was not remarked upon either. The film is a beautiful study, wonderfully photographed, a beautiful soundtrack, and very minimal dialogue. And it is a film that should be watched in context with its time.
Mm-hmm.
However, in 1935, some promoter got his hands on it after Haidee had married and retired. Some promoter here in the United States got his hands on it and brought it over to the U.S. And because of the brief nude scene and the simulated sex, it was considered pornographic by our prurient standards in 1935. So it was banned from the U.S., but of course, they managed to sneak it into tent shows and sideshows.
It's so ridiculous.
Exploited.
The government got involved, for goodness sakes.
Well, it's interesting, the legend, one interesting thing about writing and doing research is if you go back to the original source, mm-hmm. the original source of where this quote might have originated from, it's one thing that I learned by the years that I spent with Patricia Neal, learned a lot about celebrity, and I learned about you hear the same anecdotes, the same stories being told and retold and retold and retold, and they're either elaborated on or they're changed, you know, to fit the moment or whatever. If you go to the original source, perhaps the original newspaper quote, there you can see and be a little bit more astute and a little bit more objective as to what really happened. So looking at the reviews for Ecstasy, even in England, when Ecstasy was shown there, it was hailed for its content, its beauty, and its minimal use of dialogue. And over in the United States, there was so much brouhaha about it. And when it was shown in art studios, as they were called. People walked out in droves because they were, I guess they were expecting, you know, complete pornography, which it was absolutely not.
It's a beautiful film. I loved it.
It is a beautiful film, and it is not complete. The film that the version they show on Turner Classic Movies is the same version that is available on DVD. But there apparently was a French version that was an additional 25 minutes longer in length. I don't know what the content on that showed. I'm not surmising that it was anything more than just more of a beautiful film. But when Haiti came over to the United States in 1937, that's when the lies became legend. And in interview after interview, Haiti was told to tell them she was forced to do this because she was so young, and that nothing really happened, and et cetera, et cetera. And she wanted, you know, just to forget that that movie existed. And for the most part, people did. But certainly today, it's a lot, much ado about nothing.
Well, considering what's going on today, I mean, full frontal male nudity and all that other stuff, it's just like, it's like something that's like a PG film, you know, maybe.
Right.
That's it.
But Ecstasy in Me did give her international notoriety, if you will. And when she did come to the United States in 1937, Louis B. Mayer made the legend. The legend became truth. And even Haiti bought into it in interview afterwards until the end of her life. The same Metro Goldwyn Mayer biography shines forth. And so I think, you know, if you read Beautiful, I think you'll get to the truth of the matter. You can make your own decisions about Haiti Lamar after you read the book. But if nothing else, the facts are there. And so one thing about being a biographer, too, is that you don't want to be editorial. And, you know, you want to present what it is. You want to make your narrative interesting and
yes,
readable.
Yes, it's not stiff, and it's totally readable.
But you have to let the reader come to his own conclusions at the end of the book.
Yes.
Certainly, I had an agenda in that I wanted to show that she was a very normal human being, aside from being a film actress, an inventor, one of the most legendary beauties of all time. Still, she was very complicated and very human.
Yes.
And so I tried to put a little bit of humanity into the book as it came to its closure, just so people could wrap it all up in their minds and come to their own decisions about Haiti. Her life was her life. That's all I can say.
I want to ask you, you know, I know I've talked to many authors of books. Just recently, I talked to a man who wrote a biography of Carol Landis. And boy, does he still love him some Carol Landis. He fell in love with Carol Landis, basically. And, you know, he sends flowers like Joe DiMaggio to every birthday. And he invited me to L.A. and he'd take me to her cemetery and everything. And he was a darling. But he fell in love with her right in the course of writing this book. Mm-hmm. Did you feel you liked Hetty when you were writing this book and at the end of it, that you liked her?
Well, I certainly feel I understood her. There's certain things about Haiti Lamar that I could not understand. Mm-hmm. Her treatment of her first son, her adopted son.
We have to get into that.
In hindsight, yeah. I can only write what I research, what I find, and what I have to look
yes.
at. I scoured archives all over the world. I interviewed in depth her children, her friends, her colleagues. So there was only one leading man of hers still alive when I did my book, and that was the late Tony Martin. I got as much information from them, people who knew her, rubbed elbows, who personally knew her, as I could. And then I only had letters and personal items and archives and newspapers and other books to flesh it out. So at the end, there were things that I didn't understand why her behavior took the way it did.
Right.
In hindsight now, and I mentioned this in the film Bombshell, I'm a talking head in that. I mentioned that in hindsight, yes. She was a victim of Dr. Feelgood, the famous doctor who used to give injections.
Vitamin B injections. Which were really speed, right?
It was meth, yeah. So that explains a lot of the behavior that I heard the children telling me. And I didn't feel that I needed to, not that I needed to, because I didn't have it written down in front of me that she had a drug issue. I didn't really write that much about it in the book. But in hindsight, I kind of understand now why a lot of her behavior was the way it was.
You did once, all you wrote was one time, I think she was pulled over because they thought she was drunk. But she had just come from Dr. Feelgood. And that's the only thing you alluded to as far as her taking any drugs. That was it.
Right. And I did make a point, too. She did not, Hetty would have a glass or two of wine, but there was never a report of her being disorderly or out of control. Her children said, no, she didn't really drink. You know, she might, Bob Osborne said, yes, she might have a glass of wine or two, but Hetty did not have a drinking problem. And I think a lot of her frustration, a lot of who she was at that particular period in her life explained a lot of it, too. But again, I didn't have anything written down. I didn't have a videotape of her, if you will. So you can't, you know, you, and again, that goes into editorializing. You can't just say, well, I believe she did this. I believe she did that. You have to go with what you have. I did fall in love with Hetty. I've fallen in love with all three of my subjects, and Gloria Swanson is one of them. I'm falling in love, deeply in love, with my fourth subject.
Who?
But
you can't tell us?
I can't talk about it right now. I've spent most of the day doing some, doing more research
today. I can't
today,
wait.
So, at any rate, it's, you do fall in love with your, you have to love your subjects or you wouldn't waste your time on them. I didn't really want to do Gloria Swanson because I knew it would be overwhelming, but the publisher wanted me to, and I did it, and it was daunting, but I just could not give it up at the end, as I couldn't give up Hetty. I couldn't give up Patricia. It's hard to give up your children, and so these three books that I've had so far are my children, and yeah, I do love them. I'm protective of them.
That's what I hear. I see
red when I hear misquotes. It's all there on paper. All you have to do is look at page so-and-so in this particular book, and it's right there. You don't have to take it as the gospel if you don't want to. Mm-hmm. I don't care. But the thing is that, you know, I wouldn't put it on paper if it, I didn't feel it was the truth. At any rate, yeah, I'm not obsessed. No, I don't. I don't go to, when we did the documentary Bombshell in its original concept, yes, we did go to all the haunts in Hollywood where Hetty had lived, where she had done this, that, and the other. You kind of want to familiarize yourself that way to and also get a sense of this is a, was a reality. This is where she lived with Ilona Massey when she first came to the United States and they both had to learn English. Yes, this is the house. I've seen this room in a picture. I spent a whole day at, Hedgerow.
Where she
and Margaret and her late husband lived, and you know, you have to bring that sense of reality to your workplace. You have to, you know, I when I did my Gloria Swanson book, I was down at the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas at Austin. where her archives are kept. She kept everything, receipts from Max.
Wow.
Max Sennett. She everything was there. I held garments that she wore in Sunset Boulevard. You just have to have that sense of reality. But no, I don't kneel and worship at the throne of Gloria Swanson, Hedy Lamarr, or Patricia Neal was different. Patricia was a dear, dear friend of mine, and yes, I still love her. I miss her a great deal because I knew her personally, very personally, that's a different story. The subject I'm writing about right now, I did not know, but there is a 6 degrees of separation in that there is a personal tie involved with this story. Hmm. So,
is it a classic? You can just tell me this. Is it a classic movie person?
It is a person who worked in classic movies. Let's just put it that way. I won't ask you any more questions.
I know you can't
until it's all written out on paper.
I won't ask any.
But the thing is that it's to me. There's a reason I write these books. A lot of people don't seem to think. Well, who cares? Well, they're not movie buffs like you and me. But also, motion picture is truly, so it's debatable, could be jazz, but motion pictures, to me, is America's one true art form. And motion pictures taught us, my grandparents talking about silent movies, their parents talking about the Nickelodeons, my parents, the classic era of motion pictures. I was a child of television in the 50s and 60s. Children of today, they are raised on iPhones. But everybody has to know where they came from. And our society was created by motion pictures, how we behaved, how we treated the other people, how we observed and looked at mores and morals and also the world. We're all developed through motion pictures, good, bad, or indifferent. They did create who we are. So I prefer to perpetuate this because history is not being taught anymore.
And no, isn't that simple?
We have to know where we came from.
Yes.
Certainly in motion pictures, if you sit back of an afternoon and spend an hour and a half, 2 hours watching a classic or not so classic from the 30s or 40s, even the silent era films, which I learned to love so much more when I did my work on Gloria Swanson. Mm-hmm. If you just spend that much time, 2 hours a day, and just go with it, just simply, go with it. Turn your phone off.
Mm-hmm.
Just watch the film. It's an era of beauty and an era of what could be, should be, what shouldn't have been.
Yes.
When I was 12 years old, my mother gave me a huge scrapbook. It was bigger than me. A huge scrapbook that she had kept when she was a child in the early Depression years. And I remember at that age going through and looking at these pictures of these beautiful, beautiful people. And at 10 years of age, I thought to myself, I want to know who each and every one of these people are. So I started reading books on film. There weren't that many in those days, but books on film and film biographies.
Me too. I started.
Just to find out who they were and how they got where they were. And there was a period, like I said, right after I finished university, I went out and acted in television and in film and in theater. And, I found out what it took, not that I was, had what it took, but I did find out what it took for these people to become who and what they were. And like Robert Osborne said about Hedy Lamarr, if anybody who has ever stood in front of a camera, in front of dozens of people and had to portray someone else, memorize lines and make it real. Hedy did exactly what her character was called upon to do. And she was a fine actress. So I appreciated that. Robert had acted very early in his career as well. And so we had a simpatico. Our careers didn't develop to stardom or anything. And possibly there's a reason why. Lucille Ball told Robert Osborne, you'd best be a writer. And I think my forte has become, of course, writing. So you know, there's a reason for motion pictures. There's a reason for these types of books that I do. There are a lot of books that are coming out that are not too well written, a lot of books on film that are exploitative. And
yes.
There are some authors that shouldn't be published. And there are publishers that, you know, feel the need to publish books of people that aren't possibly viable, monetarily viable for a major publisher. There are other books coming out that are really, really good, and some of the authors are terribly, terribly good. They don't often have good editorial assistance, but at least the story of these people the stories of these people are being perpetuated, which I find thrilling. I have, you mentioned the author of the Carol Landis book. I know who you're talking about. There are a couple of authors that I totally revere.
Eric Gans. There were two people. Eric Gans was the, he was a professor in UCLA for French, and he studied French movies. That's one it was. There was another guy who did one too.
Right. My gurus, if you will, were the Arthur Mayer and Richard Griffith, who did the movies back in the 1950s, a book called The Movies, which was, you know, and James Robert Parrish did a whole plethora of books on film stars. More recent times, Barry Paris, I just so admired his way of research and writing. I have writers that I certainly admire. When I am working, as I am now on a new book, I have to be very careful what I read, because I don't want to read a poorly written book. I think I usually read right before I turn off the light at night. I don't want through osmosis for English to you know, affect my writing. So every morning I wake up, I meditate, clear my head, and approach it with
fresh,
a clear conscious. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sorry. You know what? I think I want to talk about some of her, you know, her life when she gets, you know, her marriages and mm-hmm. her children and her work. Her first marriage was in Vienna. She met, I think he was the third richest man in Austria.
In Austria. He was a munition czar. His name
yes.
was Fritz Mandl.
Yeah.
Fritz Mandl. And he was older than her. He courted her when she came back from Czechoslovakia, came back to Vienna. She was performing in a Fritz Kreisler musical called Sisi, which was about the Empress Elizabeth of Austria, who was extremely revered. Haiti was appearing in that play, and she met Fritz Mandl, who had inherited the Hurtenberg munitions factories from his father, and he was the third richest man in Austria. He, as well as Haiti, were both Jewish. And he started building up armaments. The fascist governments in the early 30s were building up armaments, and he was supplying the fascist governments with munitions, which was against the Treaty of Versailles. But he was considered an honorary Aryan because he was doing favors for them. And so Haiti married Fritz, retired from her career in 1933, and for the next 4 years, she was a trophy wife. She was extremely beautiful, sat at the table night after night while Fritz and his cronies talked about the upcoming events that were happening in Europe. And gradually, when it dawned on her that the Jews were beginning to be persecuted, Haiti knew that her time in Vienna was limited. Now, the story is that because she was so frustrated with Fritz, and because he kept her under lock and key, literally, and all the servants in their homes were spies, and et cetera, that she, in the dead of night, she fled from him in September of 1937. It is true that that did happen, but it possibly it wasn't as dramatic as that. Hedy kept in touch with Fritz until his passing in 1977.
Yeah, I read that. They were sending each other cards and stuff. Yeah.
And because he was actually, you know, her father was still alive when she married him, he was the first love, if you will, of her life. She'd had various affairs and various romances before that. But to marry, because she was raised by a mother who practiced Catholicism, she had to be serious about what she was doing. So I think she did love Fritz to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. They did keep in touch, most certainly. She never wanted to go back to him. I think they only met each other twice in the ensuing years. But at any rate, she did leave Austria and went to London. And during her time in London, she met with Louis B. Mayer, whom she and Fritz had actually met at the home of Max Reinhardt in 1934. The legend is that she met Louis B. Mayer, and he said, well, you have to keep your clothes on. We don't like our women running around naked, and I'll give you $125 a week. The true story is that she walked out on him, but she did reconsider, and by then it was too late. He had already boarded a boat for France to board the Normandy, a most luxurious ocean liner of the day, to come back to the United States. And Hedy followed him over there, and under the auspices of being a nanny to a young musician, she boarded the Normandy, and on the crossing, she impressed Louis B. Mayer enough to land a contract at $500 a week. When she landed, came off the Normandy in New York, she had a new name, Hedy Lamarr, and she went out to L.A. Sometime during that period, when she first came to the United States, she did spend time down in Mexico, which indicates to me that's where she got her divorce. There were several tries at divorcing Fritz before that, but by 1938, she was technically a free woman, and in 1939, she married her second husband, a producer at 20th Century Fox named Gene Marquet. She was in love with him at the moment, but his drinking, more so than his womanizing, got the better of their marriage, and she divorced him. And in 1943, she married John Loder, actor John Loder.
One thing I want to ask you first about Gene Markey, that's where she adopted the boy Jamesy, or whatever his name's like. She called him Jamesy.
Right, the adoption proceedings had begun when she and Gene separated. So she had to, as a single woman, which was very difficult in those days, as a single woman, she had to, you know, be very, very moral, if you will, even though she was seeing a lot of different men. She had to remain publicly decent, if you will, unquote, so that the adoption will go through. And she actually won the adoption as a single mother. Jamesy was a baby that was born in 1939, who was born in 1939. And when she married John Loder, he became James Loder. And the marriage with John Loder lasted until 1946, possibly 1947, because they separated so many times.
So, yeah.
And those last 2 years, the children were born, Denise and Anthony. And Hedy divorced. She married a few more times. Did you want me to go into those as well?
Hedy Stoddard.
Teddy Stoddard, who was a European band leader. He was also the Mr. Mexico, Mr. Acapulco.
Yeah.
He started Puerto Vallarta, if you will, with his nightclubs, et cetera. And Haiti was used quite effectively to draw the stars and to draw the public down there. That marriage didn't last but a little over a year, and she was back in Hollywood stumbling her way through bad projects and selling and auctioning off her her goods, her paintings. She had a beautiful art collection. When I interviewed Carl Reiner, he and his wife knew Haiti, and his wife, who was quite up on the arts, said that she had quite a magnificent art collection, but piece by piece she sold that off to keep her children in school. Jamesy was let go because of he was a fractious child, apparently.
Like, in what respect? That he was so bad that she just kind of like threw him away?
It's very, very interesting. I had interviews that James had given the public, had given over many years. And he is also in Bombshell. And if you watch Bombshell, they do interview on Netflix, a complete version of Bombshell. They do interview James, and he talks very briefly and succinctly about his mother. He was very fractious, very abrasive child, apparently. This is what Haiti told her daughter. And so she sent him off to military school, and he felt abandoned, as a lot of adopted children do. He felt abandoned, and yet he found a closeness with the headmaster and his wife. And he came home at the age of 10 or 11 or 12 and told Haiti that he wanted to live with them. And because of whatever reasons, whatever frame of mind Haiti was in, and certainly with her career nowhere, no studio to help her, no man in her life to help her. She was struggling, you know, to keep herself afloat as well as her children in school. She said, well, then go with them. And she let him go. Normal, I say normal, but middle-class people like myself, that's hard to fathom and understand, you know. But we weren't children. I wasn't raised a child of celebrity, so I can't surmise and editorialize again why or, you know, or give judgment of. It's just how it was. And so that's how it was. And he was raised by another couple. But she did marry Teddy Stauffer, and then she married a last time.
No, W. Howard Lee.
She married Howard Lee. Howard Lee, most certainly. I don't want to forget Howard Lee.
53 to 60.
That was the longest duration. Yeah. And actually, Denise told me she liked Howard Lee. She said that he afforded us the closest thing to a stable home life, if you will, even though he and Hetty fought terribly. He afforded them a home life in Houston, which they had never really experienced before. And she said she liked, Denise told me she liked him a great deal. Unfortunately, he was an alcoholic and a millionaire. You know, certainly Hetty was attracted to that. But the marriage came to an abrupt and crude end. If you do see the film Bombshell,
I'm going to watch it tonight. Are you kidding?
It's a fascinating picture because the director Alexander Dean. It was produced by Susan Sarandon. The director Alexander Dean has really captured the story of Hetty Lamarr. And then Hetty's last marriage was a very brief marriage to Louis Boys. And after that, she never married again. As a matter of fact, she became a recluse toward the end of her life.
I want to say
we haven't talked about a couple of major things.
I would like to. One thing I want to say with Howard Lee, he ended up marrying after he divorced Hetty.
Jean Tierney.
Yeah, and she was with him till his death, and then she never remarried again. So let's talk about what you think we missed with Hetty, because there's a lot of stuff.
Well, of course, we missed the invention during World War II.
Yes.
This is what makes Hetty very unique among all film stars. She left a canon of film work, but she also left a scientific invention. And in 1940, she brainstormed with musician, avant-garde musician George Antheil, on an effective way to guide torpedoes to hit their mark.
Well, first he was a gland guy, right? He was doing all this glandular study.
their original meeting was at the home of Janet Gaynor and her husband, MGM fashion designer Adrian. Mm-hmm. And this was in fall of 1940. Mm-hmm. The United States was not in the war at that time, but our eventual allies were losing in the North Atlantic. And Hetty met George Antheil at this dinner party, and she was most interested in how to develop her bosom. He had written, George Antheil had an avocation of, he had a great interest in the glands. And he had written a series of articles in Esquire magazine, some of them under a pseudonym, about how women could develop their busts.
Their mammary glands.
Yes, through injections. So Hetty was most interested about that. Being European, she didn't think at all one way or the other to bring it up at the dinner table. And nobody has recorded what Janet Gaynor or Adrian were thinking at this time.
But, she was writing notes, right?
George Antheil, in his book, Bad Boy of Music, did write about the conversation that evening. And so they did meet afterwards at Hetty's for dinner. There was no romantic involvement there. And they started talking about the glands, and one thing led to another, and they eventually got around to talking about the war, the pending war with the United States entry into it. And they started talking about how they could possibly submit a patent to the U.S. government, was accepting ideas on how to aid the United States should we enter the conflict. And George and Hetty came up with a patent. They had three patents, actually. But the patent that gained the most renown was wireless communication. Hetty called it frequency hopping. And they submitted this to the U.S. government, to the Navy, and the Navy didn't quite know what to make of it. How do you get a piano into a torpedo? Antheil's contribution was just like a piano roll, which automatically turns pianos on and plays music, possibly through this concept of receiver and sender, you could guide these torpedoes. Government didn't know what to do with it, and so they put their secret, hot secret project in mothballs, and told Hetty her best gambit would be to go out and entertain the troops.
Sell war bonds.
And sell war bonds, which she did.
I got to ask you this, though, Stephen. Mm-hmm. In your book, you also wrote, Hetty learned a lot of this knowledge because her first husband was a munitions guy. And she, you know, she was bored, but she sat around while they talked and she listened. And she learned stuff just by listening to them. They didn't know that.
Well,
she retained all that, and that's how she
listened to the conversation about what was happening.
Right.
No, the U.S. government and Richard Rhodes, or rather the German government, Richard Rhodes specifically delineated this in his book, Hetty's Folly. The German government was not developing a wireless communication at that time. They were talking about it, but they weren't. What Hetty listened to was what the German government was, how they were going to proceed once they took over Austria, the Anschluss, once they actually invaded Poland in 1938. She listened to what was going on, and there was a hatred for Hitler. And as was George Antheil, had a hatred for Hitler because his younger brother was the first U.S. casualty of World War II, shot down in a plane before the U.S. entered into the war. But at any rate, Hetty, what she listened to was she knew where the Germans were going, and anything she could help with, she wanted to do. She was extremely patriotic. She didn't become a U.S. citizen until 1953, but she wanted to do for the government. So they submitted this patent. Government didn't know what to do with it. It became dormant. It expired in 1959, but in 1962, the government had to find ways our ships could communicate when Kennedy sent ships to barricade Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
Not the Bay of Pigs, the Cuban Missile Crisis. And so they readdressed the Hetty Lamarr George Antheil patent, and it became the nucleus now for every cell phone, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth.
Amazing, isn't it?
Today.
She didn't get a penny for that, did she?
She did not, but 3 years before her death, she passed away in 2000. In 1997, the international scientific community did acknowledge her as having one of the most brilliant minds of the 20th century. And interestingly, today, November 9, is her birthday, and that is International Scientific Day. And in the country of India, it is called Hetty Lamarr Day. She is so revered there as a woman of vast intelligence and respect. And Hetty never got that, certainly not in Hollywood, certainly not during the majority of her lifetime. And I think that because of that, I think there's an interest now, certainly with Hidden Figures, the movie Hidden Figures, and other women in science now being recognized. I think there's a huge movement of appreciation of women in our culture, in our history, and I think right now is the most brilliant time to have all this happening about Hetty Lamarr. Certainly the movie Bombshell has perpetuated now the truth about her. When I was coming of age, Mel Brooks had the movie Blazing Saddles. And yeah. In the film, comedian Harvey Korman's character's name was Hetty Lamarr. And the running joke throughout the film was, "Oh, Hetty," and he'd say, "It's Hetty Lamarr." So for two generations, my generation and the one after, when the name Hetty Lamarr was brought up in conversation, people would snicker. Even today, when I post about my book or on Facebook, when I post about my book or when I post about Bombshell or whatever else is happening with Hetty Lamarr, someone will inevitably go mention in comments, "It's Hedley." And I can guarantee you those people are over 40. And today, young children in school, if you ask a young child, "Have you ever heard of the name Hetty Lamarr?" "Oh, she invented something."
They really do? You're kidding. It's taught
in
school?
No, it's actually, I'm in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and I have people, very progressive up here, education, and I have people come in and say, "We talk about Hetty Lamarr in class."
That's fabulous.
So, and I think that's wonderful because, you know, it's people, young people, these little sponges, these young people, they have to know where they come from. They have to know who came before them. Years ago, child actress Margaret O'Brien and I brainstormed. We were talking at Brandeis University, and we were brainstorming what we were going to talk about. Well, we both talked about to these young film people, who came before them and why they have to know who these people were and what they had to go through to open these doors for them today. So young people, certainly those who are interested in science and interested in communications, should know the name Hetty Lamarr. And I think my book came out at a very fortuitous time. It certainly perpetuated other books to be written about Hetty, and now this documentary. Other projects are in the making. And, Hetty Lamarr is a very unique actor in film history. She's the only one, like I said, that has left us with a dual legacy.
Yeah.
one in film and one in science.
And when they only, most people just thought of her as beautiful. And as she said, she thought her beauty was a curse. But at first, it wasn't a curse. And in Robert Osborne's, it's very funny. When he first meets Hedy Lamarr, he walks into the house and he said he sees the ugliest painting you could ever see in your life.
Yeah, and umbilical cord.
And Hedy Lamarr said she painted it and it's called Umbilical Cord. And he loved it. He said it could have been a flower, it could have been this. But no, this ugly thing now made sense, and it was umbilical cord, and he fell for her like that, and said she was down to earth and fun.
You find with a lot of intelligent people, there's a bit of eccentricities going on there, and Hedy, you know, painted. She relaxed. She liked her paint. Mm-hmm. Liked to paint. I've seen a lot of her artwork, and to me, it's a bit strange, but, you know, I don't know that much about art. I just know what I like, what I don't like. Some mm-hmm. of it I do like. But Bob always used to talk about that story about meeting her for the first time. And he said, I knew instinctively I was going to like her. And he did. They had a wonderful time. I always tape my interviews, even if they're, you know, we're sitting at the table right across from each other.
I
always tape it. And there are a lot of chuckles in that conversation that Bob adored Hedy. They had to stop being friends there for a while when Bob's career started taking off, and she would call in the middle of the night and everything. So that, you know, in every relationship, you know, there it develops and sometimes it draws apart for a while. He always adored her, though, and Bob was a good man.
I loved him.
Certainly knew his movies. He certainly knew.
Oh my God!
Knew what how to interview. I liked his interview.
I did too. Oh my God!
And I used to emulate him a great deal when I would do my interviews. I still like to think I do a good interview when I talk to people for my projects.
I'm sure you do. And if you had him as a mentor, my God, he was amazing. And you were friends. You were telling me earlier you would go to dinner and you guys would meet up or whatever. But he was such a one. You know, I always loved classic movies. But once I got to TCM and Robert Osborne, with all of his knowledge of behind the scenes and the actors and the movies, I got so into it. I learned so much and I picked up so much to start reading different things on my own. He made me a more intense lover of classic film. And I, you know, he was my comfort man. I adored him.
Well, he had a strong likability factor. Oof. Certainly the celebrities and stars that he interviewed because of his knowledge. And I think that's one reason I tend to get good interviews myself, is because you have to do your homework when you talk to people. And, you know, when you interview people. And
I agree 100%.
Bob knew his films, and you don't want to ask the typical questions. You know, what was it like? You know, how many times can you ask the same question? And you can see, certainly with people of celebrity, you can see their eyes kind of roll back in their heads when they get the same question all the time. So I try to be a little direct, try to get, you know, right down to the meat of the interview,
the
so they don't
gritty.
Feel bored.
Yeah,
but you also have to have a bit of compassion and a bit of you know, to understand that these people are sensitive individuals.
And also intuitive, don't you think?
Pardon me?
Intuitiveness as well. If you're seeing just something going on in their eyes or something, you have to know, okay, this is not good. Because some people can't read
absolutely.
People at all. Some people
no,
just
that's
can't.
That's true. And again, I learned so much in the 20 years I knew Patricia Neal, because she was a star. She was a celebrity.
How'd you meet her?
I would observe the behavior of other people around her. I would observe her behavior toward the other people, toward others. And so I just, you know, it's interesting to be involved and around a celebrity. I kind of like my anonymity sometimes myself, you have to, when you interview like Bob, you have to know your subject. And I think, you know, you're right about intuition. You have to know how far you can go with it and how far you can't. So it's interesting, though, most of the people that I've interviewed with are open books. They are, you know, I think I've had many of them say, thank you, you've asked me questions I haven't been asked before. I've had several of them say, you know, I like to speculate on that. That's what, you know, thank you. Very seldom have I had a rough interview. I certainly can remember on one hand how many I have, but it's because I have led it in the wrong direction and not because they've taken over. So Bob was very, very good. He didn't, we didn't talk on terms of he's a celebrity and I'm a writer, an author. We talked on terms of the fact that we had a mutual love for these individuals. The three subjects I've written about, Patricia Neal, Hedy Lamarr, and Gloria Swanson, certainly on those three women, he had a great empathy for all three of them. And he liked my work a great deal, which I terribly appreciated.
Yeah, I would be thrilled. It would be like getting, you know, like the Pulitzer Prize. If he likes my work, I'm glad, you know. It's like, because he's so great. What a great interviewer. With Hedy, okay, so she did her first, you know, she became such, you know, she became sort of like always suing people and always having some lawsuit going on for a while, that people were kind of getting frustrated with that.
And well, she was in a period where she didn't have that steady income from the studios, and she was protective of her image, if you will. She was also very, as Robert said, very capricious, and she would sign things without studying it. When her autobiography, again, quote unquote, Ecstasy and Me came out, she never read it and she signed off on it. That's why she didn't get any money when she sued them, because 9/10 of it was fiction. And Bob said, I was there when she got the manuscript and she signed off it. And he said, then we started reading it. And
oh, my
goodness.
She didn't read
what those writers had written.
Wasn't one of them her psychiatrist? And she sued that he took private conversations with her and put it into the book?
Well, that was her one gambit. When the lawsuit did go to the New York State Supreme Court, her one trump card was, you know, the psychiatrist did the foreword to this book, and he should never have divulged this story to these ghostwriters, at least not for publication. And he did. Well, the problem with that was she had filed her lawsuit, I think, out of state, and through a glitch in the system, they threw it out of the courts because she had not filed it in the state of New York. So she almost did win that particular lawsuit, but it was her own, as Bob said, capriciousness that she signed off with, because Hedy wanted money. Who doesn't? You know, you have to keep a roof over your head. But at that time, she was living in near poverty. Her kids were finally out of school. They were independently trying to find their own way. Mm-hmm. But she was trying to keep a roof over her head.
And how come she had no money? Was it bad investments, or
you'd have to marry the wrong guy?
And
you'd have to read the book.
I did.
It's in the book. She lost a lot of it, paying off legal fees, of course,
for her little.
And she thought that was the one way that she could, you know, keep a roof over her head, was constantly sue. If someone sneezed and she didn't like it, she would sue them. But it also cost her every dime she had. So at any rate, you know, she did not die in poverty, as the Inquirer and other tabloids reflected. There was a Canadian company, Corel, up in Canada, who used her image on some hardware or software that they had, and she had a very savvy lawyer in Florida who won her a multimillion-dollar lawsuit, and she lived comfortably enough the last years of her life in Florida. When she did pass away, she left several million to her children. So Hetty was not broke when she died, and her life wasn't possibly as tragic as it's made out to be. When you watch Bombshell, there are sad, very, very sad aspects because the images are there to reinforce.
Yeah.
And you'll see that possibly, you know, she withdrew. She withdrew from her children and her grandchildren, which
towards the end of her life.
Toward the end of her life, at least physically. She talked to them on the phone. She loved them. They knew she loved them. But yet she didn't get, you know, she didn't fill their needs, if you will, by being there. And there were reasons for that, and you'll see that in the film. So there is sadness, but I think with this production, this very respectful, very, very well done documentary, I think there is a bit of a closure there in some aspects for the children, for the family. Certainly, Hetty has been given her due. They used my book extensively throughout this film, I'm very proud of my contribution to that picture.
You should be. And your book is great. Jeez.
Well, thank you.
Can we talk just about a little bit about Hetty's life in Florida before she died? She went there, she bought a little place, and then again she was arrested, I don't know, for shoplifting $13 worth of stuff. And why would they even bother? Wasn't she in her 80s? You know, why do you want to do this to this woman for?
She was, and the thing was, she was involved with people that, I guess, kind of set her up.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones that were actually the ones, according to the newspaper articles that I read, because who knows, but the newspaper articles kind of verified that the individual she was with at this pharmacy actually was taking the items. It wasn't, you know, she was so elderly at that time.
Yeah. How old was she, like 83 or 84?
She was in her, I think, 78 or 79. And they just basically said, you know, you're on probation. You know, we're not going to put you in jail at your age, you know. And it's such a minor thing.
It's horrible. Was it for the National Enquirer? Did he do it for, like, the National Enquirer to get some picture of her or something saying she's still a shoplifter?
No, I don't. You know, my understanding was it was the other person she was with, a transgender individual, I think.
And they took off.
Makeup or something like that.
And they took off and left Hetty to take the rap. Yeah.
So at any rate, it was an embarrassment, certainly. And Denise went to bat for her mom and spoke with the press and everything. And it eventually blew over. It's really not something that I wanted to expound upon. Even right now, I don't want to expound upon it, simply because it's distasteful.
It is distasteful.
That age,
it makes me angry that it was even printed, that they did that.
It's not, I don't believe it was anything, you know, Hetty, I think, was totally innocent of that.
And you know what? Would it have been an 83, 79, whatever, Phyllis Smith? Would it go into the papers? No. It's Hetty Lamarr, and it was just something that she shouldn't have had. I remember reading that, and I was really upset. And I didn't really even know who Hetty Lamarr was, but I was just like, here she is. And, you know, I'm like, why are you bothering? I thought it was mean. I thought it was really mean.
I just think it was opportunist.
People can be poops, but
her years in Florida, she had some very close friends in Florida, neighbors and people who loved, and she Still has a very lovely friend up in New York.
Yeah, I loved her, the Long Island lady. Yeah.
Yeah, and she would come and visit Arlene, and Arlene, you know, they were the best of friends. They were quite simpatico in their outlook on life and their travel. They loved to travel, and they had wonderful times together. Arlene was is a lovely, lovely lady.
Oh, you met her and talked
person,
to her.
And Hetty's life was as she wanted it to be. I don't know for whatever reasons, you know, you'll have to talk to the angels about it. Why she withdrew from her children, I think because she just got tired of trying to keep up the image of the Hetty Lamarr everybody wanted to remember. Her career kind of wound down when she still was the beautiful, dark-haired Hetty Lamarr. And in the course of the decades that followed, as we all do, we change.
Of course.
She was still a beautiful, attractive woman, but she did not look like Hetty Lamarr. And she just got tired of it because there was no way to keep it up. Unfortunately, she did have plastic surgeries that did not work.
Really? And, how old was she when she got her plastic surgeries?
Plastic surgeries to correct those plastic surgeries. She started, I think, in the 50s when she was in her 40s. But they altered her appearance and
not for the better,
and
you say.
People, and like Bob Osborne said, people would always come up and say, oh, you were with Hetty Lamarr. They never ask, how is she? Is she doing well? How's her health? They always would say, what does she look like? And Bob said, I could see that. I could see why Hetty would withdraw. And I think her children, you know, they've put into perspective who their mother was. Mm-hmm. And certainly, you know, with what is happening with her legacy now, I think this gives them joy, because I know she, and they know that she would have appreciated being appreciated in her own lifetime. So that is pretty much how Hetty Lamarr should be looked at.
And it's beautiful.
She had a beautiful, beautiful woman in her lifetime, but people during that era couldn't see past that image. And she did have one of the most brilliant minds of the 20th
That's
century.
That's amazing. And nobody knew it except a few people. All they looked at was that. And it really made me sad when, in Robert Osborne's introduction, he said, you know, when she was 47, they're looking at her and they're all disappointed in her. And it's like, what is wrong with people? You know, they're really not very bright. These are the kind of people who go to funerals and eat popcorn and hot dogs of Hollywood celebrities. You know, it's just, I don't get people. I really don't sometimes, that they can be so cruel. And like the people on stage are infallible, and God forbid you age. Do you think it's more forgiving now of aging actors and actresses?
Well, you know, certainly, like Susan Sarandon said when Beautiful premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival in April of last year, she was on stage for a Q&A afterwards, and she said Hetty Lamarr, you know, was told she was washed up in Hollywood at the age of 40. Susan said, I don't think my career really flourished until I hit 40. Susan, you know, is a few years older than 40, but her career is still a strong, positive, in-demand career.
With the one she did just recently with Jessica Lange, The Feud, Joan and Betty, yeah.
But, you know, if I think age is more or less irrelevant now, you know, you have to remember that Marilyn Monroe, at the age of 36 when she died, was considered,
husband.
Old woman.
That's horrible.
And, and so, you know, that was 50, 60, 55 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, age, in my research right now, I just brought up an obituary of this individual who was involved in this person's life and died at the old age of 71. And I'm thinking, what? What do you mean old
age? They said old age.
Yes. So, you know, it's kind of like the old age of 71. You know, Jane Fonda's pushing 90 and she's
gorgeous.
Is
she really?
No, she's only 80. How old is she?
But my God, 80. Is she gorgeous?
She's 81, I think.
She's a powerhouse.
She will turn 80 this year. She's gorgeous.
Beautiful.
Beautiful woman. I mean, and it's not, you know, it's, I say that, and that's almost an insult. She's still vital, is what I should be saying.
She's still vital.
She's talented. She's still involved. You know, I know people 30 years old who are old.
I do too.
I know people 30 years old who are not involved in ages.
I knew people as teenagers that were old.
My apologies to Jane Fonda. I shouldn't have said she's still gorgeous. She is gorgeous.
She's gorgeous.
80 years old, and that means nothing because she's still a productive individual. And
doing her series.
Very much with. Absolutely.
Doing everything.
So anyway, it has changed then.
This is what we're saying.
Most certainly has.
Thank God.
Definitely.
Yes.
Yes.
And one more thing I want to say. You know, Jane Fonda was on Bill Maher, and this was one of the things I wish Jane Fonda smacked him. He said, the hottest old lady is Jane Fonda, and out she comes. Is that a way to introduce Jane Fonda? I don't even think of her as an old lady.
I think if it's tongue-in-cheek, you know, I did a book signing when Patricia Neal, An Unquiet Life, came out. I did a book signing, I think, I don't remember, it was in Virginia somewhere, book fair or something like that. And Jane Fonda, her autobiography had just been published in paper, and she sat beside me, and we signed books for people. And everything. And when she walked in, I just thought, I... like her or not, here is Jane Fonda, who has contributed a great deal to film and theater as well. She has had her good moments and she's had her bad moments. And this was 10 years ago.
And she's still standing.
She was beautiful, absolutely gorgeous. And I think what made her gorgeous was not because she looked young.
Right.
You know, that could be artifice.
Yes.
But I think what made her beautiful was the fact that she was involved and she was smiling and she was with it and she was looking at people and talking and communicating with people.
Which is quite attractive and beautiful.
And so that, you know, if you're vital, if you're involved, that's your beauty. That's what makes you, you know,
I agree 100%.
A beautiful person. And certainly as I get older, I don't take very much at face value anymore. So
me either.
At any rate, Hedy Lamarr has left us a lot more than just face value with her legacy. Every time I pick up a phone, I have to thank Hedy.
Yes, isn't it amazing? And I can't wait to see Bombshell. Because I am going to watch it tonight if it's on Netflix. It's in my queue for Amazon, but I didn't know it was on Netflix as well.
And well, it's on Netflix all the time at any time. So
really? Yeah. I have to check it out. I will watch it tonight. And like I'm going to tell everybody, the book is good. I am a person who can skip through biographies. Like I'm boring, boring. I did not skip through this. I read every page, every page.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
And that means a lot because, you know, I'm freely admitting I don't read every page of every person's book that I interview, but I did with you. I loved it. And it just got me so into it. I felt really into her life and everything that went on. And I do have, of course, the Gloria Swanson book. And I know I must have read the Patricia Neal one, but is that still in print? Can I get that still?
Oh, yeah, you can order it on all three of my books on Amazon.com. You can order through Barnes & Noble in hardcover paper.
Cool.
I don't think Gloria is in paper, but the other two are in paper and, of course, ebook. And, you know, I'd like to think that I do a definitive work. And so all three of my books are definitive biographies. They're something in the future that other people can base their books on. I include filmographies and everything at the back of my book.
You have everything. It's amazing.
They're very heavily annotated so that you can see where these sources came from. And I think Gloria was such a huge, Gloria Swanson lived, you know, to be quite elderly. And her book was so huge, I think they left out the career study, which if you go to my webpage, Stephen Michael Scheer, look it up on Google and go to my webpage. Somewhere on my webpage, you can click on and get a complete career filmography, theater, television, radio work. But it was there was just too many additional pages for the book. But my Patricia and Haiti both have the chronologies at the back of the book.
I would love you to come on and discuss your other books anytime.
Well, certainly. Let's set it up sometime.
Yes, I hope you had a good time because I thought you were fabulous. And like I said, I love your books. I have my Gloria Swanson one. And I believe I read Patricia Neal, but I'm going to get it again to reread it. So I would certainly love to have you on again. I know the listeners would love you. And I want you guys to know this is Stephen Michael here. And he, am I giving your name right? He did the best books, Hedy Lamarr, beautiful. Gloria Swanson, what's the name of that one? Gloria Swanson, I have it on my...
It's Patricia Neal, An Unquiet Life, Beautiful, The Life of Hedy Lamarr, and Gloria Swanson, The Ultimate Star.
The Ultimate Star, and I really want to talk about her, because what a life. She had some kind of life. And so did Patricia Neal. I mean, really, she did. And I love that you were her friend. Anyway, you can go to his website, Stephen Michael Scheer. You can look at the books. You can do whatever. And I'm looking forward to talking to you again on both of those ladies, if you'd like to come on, because you were just fabulous.
Well, thank you, Grace. Yes, it'd be my pleasure.
Great. Yeah. So I want to thank you so much, Stephen. And your book was fabulous. His Hedy book. Beautiful. And you guys watch Bombshell because you'll see him on there. How about that?
Yeah.
So take care. And thank you. Thank you so much, Stephen. Thank you.
Thank you, Grace. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And we will soon be back with another episode of True Stories of Tinseltown. And thank you guys for listening. Bye-bye.
Stepped out of a dream. You are too wonderful to be what you seem. Could there be smiles like yours? Could there be eyes like yours? Could there be lips like yours? Honest and truly, you stepped out of a cloud. I want to take you away, away from the crowd.